And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Machuda.
And welcome, everybody, Hands-On Apologetics. You have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. It's great to be with you and to have yet another foray into explaining, defending, sharing the faith with confidence and clarity. And it's good to be with you today. This week is interesting. All the programs seem to be centered around the positive aspects of the faith. And, you know, we talked about heaven with Sister Mary Ann earlier this week. We talked about, you know, conversion to the faith. And today we're going to talk about beauty and to help us work through beauty, what it is and why it matters. John Mark Maravelli is going to join us, talk about his book on beauty. And, you know, it's going to be a fascinating discussion because I think many of us really haven't thought much about it. We can recognize beauty, but what is beauty? Is beauty somehow connected with truth? Is it somehow connected with virtue? If someone is filled with truth and virtue, will they be able to appreciate beauty more? Why do we need beauty? How does beauty lead us to God? You know, great stuff, interesting questions. And like I said, John Mark Maravelli is going to come on after the first break to help us work through it. we're also going to do our critical thinking skills, and today's critical thinking, the finding the fallacy for today, is the straw man fallacy, extremely common fallacy, and one that you should be aware of, and we're going to talk a little bit about how to defeat it. Also, as always, we are going to meet one of the early church fathers, and today's early church father is Zosimus. Actually, one of my favorites, not exactly a household name, but a very important historian, earlier historian from the 5th century. So that's going to be our Meet the Early Church Father for today. And as always, you are part of the program. So if you wish, especially when Dr. Maravelli comes on, give us a call at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. Love to hear from you. Or, as always, you can send us your emails. Maybe there's a situation you're in. Maybe you're discussing the faith with coworkers. Maybe a child or a loved one is having questions about the faith, and you just like somebody to bounce off, you know, your ideas, or maybe ask for ideas. Shoot us an email at questions@handsonapologetics.com. That comes directly to me, and I check out every email and respond to it. And occasionally, I will bring those up in a email show. And folks, you know, I wanted to do it this week. We were unable to do it. So I think next week I'm going to plan on doing a dojo mailbox show, which is always fun because there's some really great points, suggestions, comments that have been piling up, and I want to get to them because it's really great material. And I also want to bounce it off you. You know, this would be great to that we are a community of apologists, defenders of the faith, just ordinary Catholics who, you know, maybe when you listen to these scenarios or questions, you might have your own take on it that was superior to any other. So anyway, the email address once again is questions@handsonapologetics.com. And that's always good. Also, I should give my shout outs to those watching live stream on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody live streaming. Good to see familiar names in the chat room, as always. And thank you for the colorful emojis, by the way. Appreciate it. And, you know, thank you for listening on the radio and via podcast. So why don't we jump into the finding of the fallacy for today? Like I said, the finding of the fallacy is the straw man fallacy. And basically, the straw man fallacy is a form of argument. It's actually an informal fallacy that gives the impression of refuting an opponent's argument while actually refuting an argument that was not presented by that opponent. In other words, what you do in the straw man fallacy is you make a mock-up of the person's position that's not accurate, and then you basically beat the stuffing out of it. And strawman fallacies can be very, very effective because if the audience doesn't know better and they're not carefully listening, it could seem like someone just beat the daylights out of another person in conversation or debate. This happens a lot in debates where you think, wow, this person's scoring a lot of points. But what you find out is actually the position they're arguing against isn't the position of their opponent. It's a straw man. It looks like the opponent's position, but it's not. And by the way, the opposite, what you don't want, so you never want to do a straw man argument. You never want to have a straw man fallacy committed because, like I said, it's almost like a non sequitur. I mean, even if it's true, it doesn't refute the person's opponent, the position. What you want to do is you always want to take care to correctly represent the other person's opponent. And there's actually a term for that. It's called steel man as opposed to the straw man. You want to make the person's objection, if you can, as faithful as possible and even as strong as possible. And that's one of the reasons I love St. Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologica. Because the whole work, whenever he comes up with a question, he proposes the best objections to a particular point. And he actually makes their opponent's position, you know, as strong as possible so that when he refutes it, you know, he really does destroy the argument. He does prove his point. So, you know, we want a steel man. We don't want a straw man. And by the way, you know, the one thing to prevent straw man fallacy being used on you is catechesis, folks. That's why apologetics is kind of the handmaid of catechetics. You need to know the faith. You need to study the faith and understand the faith as clearly as possible. That way, when someone tries to make a straw man of your position, you can immediately say, oh, hold on a second, you're wrong. We don't believe this. We believe that. All right. So be well catechized, and that will, if it won't eradicate the possibility of straw man fallacy being used on you, at least, you know, it's going to guard you against it. So that's our fallacy for today. So straw man fallacy. Now, let's go to the Meet the Early Church Father. And like I said, the Early Church Father's known name is Zosimus. Actually, if you want the full name, it's Solomon Hermas Zosimus Scholasticus, who died sometime after AD 439. Zosimus grew up near Gaza in southern Palestine. He was born to a pious Christian family. We don't know a lot about his life. We know that he eventually traveled to Italy and then settled in Constantinople, where, like Socrates, and by the way, this is not Socrates, the ancient Greek philosopher, Socrates Scholasticus, another early church father and historian, he practiced law. We don't have a date to assign for his birth, and we're not really sure when he died, other than he was still alive in 439. He's known for his work, The History of the Church, which was written somewhere around, you know, 439, 450, near the end of his life. He actually wrote two histories of the church. The first covers a period from the ascension of our Lord to AD 323. Not all of its extent. We do have little fragments of it. And then the second history covers from 323 to 439 AD, ending, like also Socrates, in the reign of Theodosius II. The latter work is, as it concerns us, is found extant in almost its entirety. So we have the entirety of this second history. We're only lacking a couple of chapters in the ninth and the final book. So that covers about 14 years. So it's substantially here. Zosimus is a fascinating early church father. If you ever get a chance, do try to read his history. He uses a lot of different sources, very broad sources. He sometimes plagiarizes other people. Of course, back then, you know, it wasn't called plagiarism. It was called scholarship. And, you know, so we actually have quite a bit of copying from other sources. He also uses just normal conversation, gossip, memories that people had during the period, if it's a closer contemporary period. And so it's kind of fascinating to read his work. He writes in a very pleasant manner, and he's very much, kind of an apologist. He's very engaged in certain issues. And he gives the feeling of, what the opinions were, how people looked at things, especially during his own age. So it's a very valuable work. Of course, Eusebius's Church History, I think, is probably the work, like every Catholic apologist should read. That in itself is incredibly fascinating. But I think a close second for my money would be Zosimus's Church History, that second volume. Just really cool stuff. And specifically, one of my favorite parts, and I include this in my book, Hostile Witnesses, is his description of the Julian the Apostate rebuilding the Jerusalem temple. And that's a fascinating thing, because miraculously, even though the emperor tried to rebuild the temple, God wouldn't allow it. And several miraculous things happened. And it just so happened that Zosimus recounts this in his history. And he also has the testimony of those who were working on the project, who knew about the project, people who went to the parishes in the area. So he gives some very interesting firsthand, secondhand information about what happened with the rebuilding of the temple. All right, very good. Coming up next, after the break, we're going to talk about beauty with John Mark Marigabelli. So stay tuned.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics. And, I want to just let you know that we're going to partner here with Hands-On Apologetics with John DeRosa of ClassicalTheism.com. and also with Pat Flynn of ChroniclesOfStrength.com. All three of us are going to be on a live YouTube broadcast that we're going to go through the three major areas of apologetics, and there's going to be lots of freebies and stuff. And I just wanted to let you know, to get in on all the freebies, there is now a link on the HandsOnApologetics.com website. Just follow it down and click on the part that says, "What if we could show you how to never lose a religious argument again?" Just click on that, and that will send you to a page to sign up. You'll get a free ebook on how to never lose a religious argument again. And also, you'll get information on the live broadcast and other freebies, too. So, check it out and, go to HandsOnApologetics.com. Scroll down right underneath the Hands On Apologetics radio show banner. You'll see it. Click on it and sign up. And you get a whole bunch of freebies and you get to check out the broadcast. So I just wanted to share that information with you. And, without further ado, why don't we talk about beauty, shall we? And to join us to talk about beauty, we have John Mark Maravelli, who's a professor of systematic and moral theology at Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Maryland. He received a doctorate in sacred theology from the Regina Apostolorum in Rome, and he's authored three books, including Why God? Why Jesus? Why the Catholic Church? He's debated noted atheist on the topic of God's existence, same-sex marriage, and theistic morality, and he and his wife Jessica have five children. John Mark Maravelli, welcome to Hands On Apologetics.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, the pleasure is all mine. When I saw your book, I thought, yes, this is finally an area where, we could explore something that I think has been neglected a lot, at least in the popular mind in Catholicism, that, we have such a rich tradition of art and beauty and also apologetics and theology, but it seems to have been kind of pushed by the wayside. So what got you interested in writing a book on beauty?
Well, it's an interesting story. I bike to work, and I do a lot of debating and a lot of apologetics and a lot of argumentation, policy issues. And I was just, to tell you the truth, I was just tired of arguing. And so I was biking to work, and I'd been planning on doing a new project on the problem of evil. And I just looked around, and it was a beautiful fall day. And I said, I don't really know what beauty is. I don't have a good grasp on that. I'm going to do a class on beauty. And yeah. So that's how it got started. I taught the class at the seminary, and a lot of good guys took it and helped me clarify my thoughts. And then I brought it to Sophia Institute Press, and they put it out.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome because, it is a fascinating subject. Why don't we work through that? What exactly is beauty?
Yeah, well, I try to sort of synthesize the tradition, philosophical and theological. And my synthesis is that beauty is a combination of order and surprise. So order is a thing being what it's supposed to be and acting the way it's supposed to act. And surprise is the response of the mind to something wondrous, to something that's not obvious. So an easy example is when your kid takes their first step. You're thrilled. You're excited. Some parents maybe shed a tear. What's going on? Someone says, well, look at the kid. It's a human being. They're supposed to walk, aren't they? Yes, but it's so beautiful. I just can't believe it, right? That's the sort of experience of order, of rightness, and surprise, where you allow yourself to be filled with wonder at the normal. And I would say that's what we've lost, largely. Yeah. And sometimes both church culture and secular culture is a delightful wonder at things working the way they're supposed to work.
Yeah, that's true. In a sense, we're kind of jaded, by, mechanisms, technology. It's an expectation that there will be order. And we won't look at it as something wondrous.
I think that's
true?
Certainly true. I think.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I think it's certainly true that when you worship comfort, you start to put a priority on efficiency, And when everything becomes about satisfying urges, you don't step back and see how good the thing is in itself. You just see what it can do for you. And that will jade you awfully quickly.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it's interesting. You start the book by noting something that kind of surprised me, because we often think that beauty is kind of in things. There is a beautiful thing. You know, it's like a piece of beauty out there. But you point out that beauty is actually something more of like a structure or something that's maybe manifested physically, but it's really the structure itself that is beautiful. I don't know if I got that correctly, but maybe you could pick up on that.
Yeah, so one of the traditional understandings of beauty is that it involves form. It involves the structures of things, the natures of things. So, for instance, when you look, scientists are always finding beautiful structures, whether beautiful structures in a star or even in a bug or a leaf or in a snowflake. These structures show that things have been organized. So structure or order expresses intelligence. And then the surprising part, the part that says, look, this is not obvious, this didn't have to be this way, that expresses freedom. And that's why I think the natural world is the great paradigm for beauty, because it's orderly, but it's also surprising. And so it says that there is a mind, that there is a person, there is intelligence and freedom at the back of it. And so all beauty has this structure element that you should be able to perceive, but also this recognition that the structure didn't have to be this way. And so it's the product of freedom, and it's surprising, and that gives the light.
Yeah, because it's this way instead of some other way, and that's surprising.
Exactly. Yeah, when God is making the world, he says, let's do it this way, and now let's do it this way, and now let's do it this way. And he's following a plan, right? He's following a program in those first chapter of Genesis. But he's also expressing his freedom. We don't have to do it this way. We're just going to. Let's do it this way because it's delightful.
Yeah, yeah, very good. Yeah. You know, one thing that struck me that I think confirms what you say is, well, we can understand the beauty of music. You know, it's kind of a sweetness to the ear. Or, you know, art, it's a sweetness to the eyes. But I've heard that mathematicians can see mathematical formulas as beautiful, you know, that there is this parallelism and symmetry to it. And so, you know, aesthetically, you know, on a piece of paper, you know, these mathematical formulas are kind of ugly, but there's also a beauty that's kind of embedded in it. And like you said, it's like it reflects intelligence. It's something behind those formulas that's beautiful.
Yeah, and there was a famous book by Father Dubay, The Evidential Power of Beauty, where he goes through a long list of how scientific discoveries are often made by scientists latching on to lovely, elegant formulas.
Yes.
Sort of almost intuiting that these would be fitting. So it is a gauge for truth and not just for pleasure, the notion of the beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. Let's explore that a little bit. So beauty is not only, you know, like you said, it has those two facets of, you know, the objective order and then that surprise, but it's also in line with truth as well. Maybe we could explore that. How is beauty connected to truth?
Okay, so this gets into the Catholic idea of the transcendentals, and the transcendentals are these sort of attributes that all being, all reality has. So the example I give is if you were to clap your hand in front of your face, it would be one event, but you would see it, and you would feel it, and you would hear it, because you have these different receptors. Well, human beings, we have different receptors for being at the spiritual level. And when we receive being through our intellect, that's truth. And when we receive being as a fitting object for our will that fulfills us, that's called the good. And when we perceive beauty not only through our intellect and not only through our will, but we receive it through our passions, when our passions, our feelings respond to it, that's beauty. So the reality is objective. Beauty is just as objective as goodness, is just as objective as truth, because ultimately they all reside in the same reality. But we respond differently. based on whether our feelings are sensitive, whether they're attuned, whether we've developed an appreciation for reality. And my thesis in the book is it's not enough to know the truth. It's not even enough to choose the good. We must cultivate an appreciation in our feelings for reality. That is, we have to get good at recognizing and delighting in beauty.
Hmm. Yeah, very good. Yeah, but how does one do that, though? Practically, how can you develop it so that your passions are, receptive to beauty?
Yeah, that's a great question. The number one step is temperance. If you become indulgent in your images, if you become lazy, if you become selfish in your images. So let me give you an example.
Okay.
A pornography addict has not actually delighted in a woman's beauty for a very long time. Why? Well, because he's been indulgent. He's looked too much in it, things he shouldn't look at. Mm-hmm. And he's going to have to go through a long process of self-denial before he appreciates female beauty again. People who are simply gorging themselves on their smartphones and their computers and looking at all sorts of nonsense all the time are going to lack the discipline necessary to sit and quietly appreciate the goodness of something. So the first step is that it takes discipline. It takes discipline. We have to step back. We have to make time to simply look and delight and be grateful. And that's true for a sunset, it's true for a piece of art, it's true for our kids, and it's most especially true for prayer.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, and you even point out even just dining out, food, it's a gluttony can kind of desensitize us to truly appreciating the beauty of good-tasting food.
Oh yeah, food is a major carrier for order and surprise. I think
yeah.
Culinary art is really art. But if you're greedy and you're intemperate in your food, you're not really going to savor anything. You're just going to gulp it down.
Yeah. Yeah, so temperance is important. Is there any other aspects that we would need to kind of fine-tune our passions?
Well, I would say in terms of creating beauty yourself, which is everyone's obligation, not just to appreciate, but to pursue it actively, that takes a lot of fortitude because it's very difficult to achieve the combination of order and surprise. I'll give you an example.
Hold on, John. I hear the music coming up. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have posed that.
No problem.
John Mark Maravalli about beauty, what it is and why it matters. Stay tuned, folks. We're on the other side of the break.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
We'll be right back.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We're talking about beauty, what it is, why it matters, and to join us to explore this is author and professor Mark Miravelli on beauty, what it is, what it matters. It's put out by Sophia Institute Press. And like I said, this is an area I think that has been neglected, certainly in apologetics and I don't know, at least in the spheres books that I read. Now, John Mark, right before the break, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you, but we were talking about ways in which we can refine our passions to better appreciate beauty, discern beauty. And you were mentioning about creating beauty ourselves.
Yeah, and specifically, if I could go back to that connection between truth and beauty, especially since this is an apologetics show.
Yes.
Chesterton once said that a paradox is a truth standing on its head to get your attention. So if beauty is supposed to be equivalent intrinsically to truth, and if beauty demands order and surprise, we should be very nervous when preachers of the truth are neither orderly nor surprising.
Yeah.
Right? There's an awful lot of people who get up to speak about some matter of the faith, and they're disorganized, and they don't say anything particularly insightful or stimulating. Mm-hmm. That's not good, right? It takes away the luster of the truth if you're disorganized and you're not surprising, if you just repeat platitudes.
Right.
And so I would say this is a key area where it takes a lot of effort to be organized and to say something fresh, something that is true, and yet say it in a new way in order to bring the full brilliance, the full splendor of truth to your audience. So that would be, for instance, a way of speaking beautifully that I think would help a lot of people convey the faith more effectively.
Yeah, very good. So it's always that order side and also the surprising side that kind of need to be combined in order to get the experience of beauty.
Yeah, I think definitely. I think that's got to be there, and that's tough. We were talking about food before the break.
Yeah.
My wife works very hard to bring beauty to our table, and that means she does things that are orderly, that are healthy, that are not going to poison us, but are nutritious. But she surprises us. She changes it up. She switches it up. She's a real artist. She helps my kids and myself develop our palates and appreciate new kinds of food. That's a continual challenge to be able to celebrate reality. And as I said, it takes the temperance of self-restraint, but it also takes the fortitude of creativity.
Yes. Yeah, very good. Now, it's, one could look at a very beautiful painting, be surprised, the light and its order. But if you're continuously looking at the painting, eventually the surprise wears off. Although the painting hasn't changed, our experience of beauty kind of fades. Does that have any apologetic value in terms of is beauty functioning to point to itself, or is it pointing to something else?
Yeah, that's a great point too. Certainly, all created forms of truth, goodness, and beauty are insufficient ultimately, and so they get us started. And Plato, actually, at the end of the Symposium, writes about the quest of human life is to go from finite forms of beauty to the uncreated beauty. I would also say that, and I point this out in the book. One of the atheists I debated describes the way I would say he wasn't able to make sense of the beauty of nature anymore. He and his uncle went to look at a beautiful landscape, and his uncle, who was a Christian, said, "Look how beautiful this is." And the atheist, his name was Dan, just said, oh, yeah, well, you can see the erosion patterns here, and you can see sort of the tectonic shift here, and you can see the improbable angle there, I guess, if that's what you mean. And the uncle said, no, why do you ruin everything? So imagine,
yeah.
Imagine if two people are looking at a beautiful painting, and one is really captivated by the beauty of it, by the spiritual significance, and the other just drones on about the chemical properties of the paint. Unless you believe that beauty is the communication of one person to another, you're eventually not going to be able to see it anymore. And that's why atheism, which usually starts out with some grand appreciation of nature, ends in not being able to appreciate even nature anymore.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, so you need to... So what you're implying is that... the closer one is to truth, the more they're able to perceive and appreciate beauty. Is that correct?
Yes, and also that if you're a materialist, you will no longer be able to see the spiritual value in material things, which is part and parcel of the whole experience of beauty.
Yeah. Yeah, why do you believe that's so?
Well, I think because... if you're a materialist, you deny that there is any spiritual charge to material things. You reduce. That's a great question. So this is, I think, maybe the principle. Anytime you reduce something to less than it is, you're taking away its beauty. If you reduce a man or a woman to a pleasure object, you're taking away their beauty. If you reduce a human being to simply their... you know, or the embryo to simply their cellular properties, you're taking away their beauty. And if you reduce a sunset to simply a chemical byproduct of an unintelligent process, you're taking away its beauty. If you take away the divine mind, the intelligence and freedom at the foundation of all things, you take away beauty.
Well, yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head on that. Yeah, right. Yeah, because there is a kind of automatic reductionism, and it doesn't see beauty. I suppose I always picture as a Christian that something beautiful is really almost like a window through which we can see the ultimate transcendent cause, you know, God, you know, somehow being manifested in finite, you know, limited ways, but it's still kind of a window that points us to something greater. But if you presuppose that there is nothing greater, then all you're left with is a bunch of stuff, basically.
Yeah, just dull glass with no light shining through. And actually, the last chapter of the beauty book has to do with Our Lady has the greatest sort of prism of supernatural light, because the saints are physical like we are, but they most incandescently transmit the divine light, which is why actually the Catechism says we canonize saints in order to highlight for people the action of the Holy Spirit. So I would contend that the greatest artwork of the Holy Spirit is Our Lady and the other saints, and that is how the divine light is most fully expressed next to our Lord's humanity in human form. And that's why the saints are not just sort of accidental sort of advantages, accessories to Catholics. They are the locus. They are the site. They are the main gallery of God's artwork.
Yes. Yeah, very good. Yeah, when I was reading your book, at first I thought you were equivocating on the word art, you know, because art can mean, you know, like a work of art, like Da Vinci's Mona Lisa. But also there's an older form of art, which means basically a work, you know, handiwork. But, you know, I realized as I was reading your book that you're actually kind of playing off both of them. I mean, they both are true. It's not an either or. It's not like... you know, one is handiwork and then another one is a picture. It's really, you know, God's work within creation that's art. I mean, it's both senses of the word.
And the traditional sense of artisan was someone who, as you point out, was excellent at making a product. But after the industrial era, we have disassociated making something and making it beautifully.
Interesting.
And that's why one of the chapters in the book is focused on beautifying the satisfaction of human needs. Right? We don't just want houses that are well-made. We want houses that are beautiful. We don't just want clothes that are efficient. We want beautiful clothes, and as I said, we don't just want food that is nutritious. We don't just want tablets that'll give us our nutrients. We want beautiful food, and that should extend across the whole realm of making. We should try to make beautifully, because again, we're in the image of God, and we want to, and because it is dehumanizing to do anything human, and to ignore order and surprise, to ignore the delight that we should be taking in reality all the time.
Yeah, very good. Do you think there's some way, you know, given mass production, that beauty could be mass produced? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I think one thing beauty can't survive is mechanistic monotony. So, for instance, there's this really wonderful video by Roger Scruton, and he first shows the image of Michelangelo's David. And then he shows a driveway where someone has made maybe 50 copies of the David and lined them all up next to each other. And it's really heartbreaking because this, you know, the staggering piece of beauty in stone is banalized. It really becomes banal. So if by mass production we mean thoughtless repetition, then beauty can never survive thoughtless repetition. Right.
Okay.
But if we mean creating a culture where people are thoughtful in trying to make excellent things across the board, yeah, that's what we want.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, that's always been kind of a dichotomy with me. I remember, the segment's almost over, but it being in class and someone lamenting how handmade goods, you know, have gone. But then again, the flip side is the poor now can have really nicely made goods. And I always wondered about that. But I'm sorry, I'm rambling. We're talking with John Mark Maravelli about his book, Beauty, What It Is and Why It Matters. More on the other side of the break, folks. Listen to Hands-On Apologetics.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with John Mark Maravalli about beauty, what it is, why it matters. And, you know, I was flipping through your book, and you were talking about the beauty in Christian art, beauty in liturgy. What has happened? I mean, it seems that at least in you know, when I was growing up, 70s, 80s, beauty in the church kind of diminished. And how do you account for this diminishment within Christian art and liturgy? Is that more on the order side, or is it on the surprise side, or is it a little bit of both?
That's a good question. I think maybe the first thing is just old economic issues. So in the Old Testament, you actually see God having to constantly remind the Israelites to make the investment to make his house beautiful. People like Solomon spend more on his own house than on the temple. Later on, prophets say, listen, stop updating your own houses when you should be getting God's house in order.
Yeah.
And Judas, of course, is the great example of someone who claims that socially urgent issues should take priority over beauty dedicated to Christ. When the woman breaks the costly ointment, right, this supremely beautiful ointment, this beauty of smell devoted to the Messiah, Judas is the one who complains and says, no, you should use that money and you should give it to the poor. So I think that became very common. It became very common to say that it was sort of scandalous to invest in beauty for God when we should be giving to the poor, although, of course, the history of the church shows that that's a false dichotomy, because the church is the greatest patron of beauty in human history, and the church is also the largest charitable organization in human history. And actually, the more you care about God, the more you do for your neighbor. So we shouldn't polarize liturgical beauty and social activism. And then I think the second one is, yeah, there's just been, in all of Western society, which has infected the church, this disproportionate focus on surprise instead of order. And when you do that, you get into a lot of weird stuff. And so people are just focusing on being avant-garde, on being sensational, on being surprising, and they forgot about making sure that that surprise was integrated into our faith and into our tradition and into our heritage and into our theology.
Yeah.
And so you end up with a lot of ugly, weird, strange churches with ugly, weird, strange art. And that's understandable because the rest of the culture has kind of gone that direction as well.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, very insightful. Yeah, very good. You know, also, you treat something that I've been thinking about for a number of years since I took a class from a professor who wrote his doctoral dissertation on the hilarity in heaven and how humor, you know, that the light of humor is going to be experienced in God in heaven. And you have a section on beauty and humor that I thought was really intriguing that you would bring, you know, humor into it. We often don't think of humor as an object of beauty.
Yeah, actually, I mean, the main reason I brought it in just at the very end of the beauty book is because humor is really a contrast to beauty. In beauty, we're surprised by order. But in humor, we're actually surprised by disorder, right? We're surprised by somebody stepping on a rake. We're surprised at somebody sneezing at the end of an important speech. And we laugh at it. But humor is interesting because beauty, we take delight in deep order. In humor, we take delight at superficial disorder or incongruity. Right? We don't. If it's really a serious disorder, we don't laugh at it. If we think it's a serious disorder, we don't laugh at it. So I think humor, and a lot of people have written on this, Lewis, Fulton Sheen, certainly G.K. Chesterton. Humor is very useful because it helps keep us aware of our smallness and of our unimportance. So, for instance, the times when God is reported as laughing in the Bible is usually at the plans of the wicked. Right? Because everyone may be terrified by the plans of the wicked, but God isn't, because he knows how small the wicked are and how impotent and how none of it's going to work out the way they plan. It's going to work out the way he plans.
Right.
So the philosopher Bergson basically says humor is a wonderful antidote, especially self-directed humor, is a wonderful antidote for vanity. Mm. And that's why I think it can be a very important complement to beauty, because we should be entranced at the glory and splendor of what God has done, and we should not take ourselves too seriously. And a lot of times you have the opposite in the art world. You have the artist or the art critic taking themselves very seriously and not taking the order that God has established seriously enough.
Yeah, that's usually the pride that leads to the fall. That usually when someone becomes so prideful, that's when their artistic work really is diminished.
Yeah, exactly. And you have the saints, you have people like Philip Neri, you have people like St. Francis, who are very good about joking. And joking largely to make themselves look little and to delight in their smallness.
Yes. Yeah, that's good. It also brings up, in some ways, disorder can enhance the order of beauty, can it? By contrast, it can bring out certain areas of beauty that otherwise wouldn't be noticed. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
That's absolutely right.
Yeah, so I think that could
be a foil.
Yeah. So, I mean, in a sense, I think that opens up an avenue for the problem of evil, that ultimately God allows evil to bring about a greater good. I suppose that would also work in the order of beauty as well.
Yes, so the best kind of beauty, the best kind of art, is the beauty that has so much order that it can actually take disorder and make it contribute to the order itself, right? The way tension in music contributes to the eventual resolution, the way tension in a plot, a story contributes to the resolution. And of course, the ultimate achievement of that art form of taking disorder and making it contribute to order is Christ on the cross.
Yes.
Because he actually takes all the disorder in the world at its height and makes it contribute to the greatest achievement of order, the reconnection, the reestablishment of order between God and creation, is effected, is achieved by Christ's use of pain, suffering, and death. And that's why Calvary is the supremely beautiful act. And Pope Benedict is very good on this. He said, listen, when we as Catholics talk about beauty, we don't just mean superficially pretty.
Yes.
We mean deep, profound order that can engage any disorder. And apologetically, this is huge. I have a friend, he was converted from being, I think, an atheist at art school to a very devout Christian who's entering seminary. And it was through Calvary. And he said, Calvary is where the culture of death has access to God. They can find their way to Christ, because that is where Christ takes the culture of death and sanctifies it for God.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because in physical terms, Calvary was most grotesque. I mean, Romans wouldn't even mention crucifixion. It was, too gruesome to even think about, for polite Roman company. Yet that physical grotesqueness is actually, shines forth like even a greater and more, deeper beauty that overcomes the grossness of it, I guess you could say.
Yeah, it's like any good, I don't know if you like murder mysteries, Gary, but...
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I like Agatha Christie. And The Road to Emmaus is a lot like an Agatha Christie novel, where the detective at the end explains all the clues that you weren't able to put together until the end. And so the beauty of Calvary is where you come to trust that God is a great storyteller.
Right.
And a good storyteller gives you clues about what the ending is going to be, but he does it so cleverly that you won't be able to guess the ending anyway. Hmm. That's precisely what Calvary is. So what I say to people when I talk about beauty is, you think of the most disordered situation you know, the most brutal, wrecked, twisted knot of a situation in your family or in your friends, and remember that God is winning there, and that God is somehow going to use that, and I'm not going to guess the ending, but God is somehow going to use that to make a fantastic ending.
Yeah. Yeah, very good. Yeah, so whatever's disordered and mundane right now, ultimately, you're going to see how it fits into the ultimate order with the ultimate surprise ending.
Yes. Every time.
Yeah, that's great. We only have a couple of minutes. You mentioned that you've debated, you're involved in apologetics. Tell us about how do you incorporate that in apologetics? Do you use beauty as part of your defense of God and Christianity and Catholicism?
You know, I haven't actually had the chance. The book just came out. But one of the things I want to focus on next time I talk to someone of a secular background is what kind of life do you want? Because the secular world offers either order without surprise or surprise without order. A lot of people, in fact, go back and forth from one to the other. They go to work at their cubicle. They find no meaning in it. They just find mindless repetition, order without surprise and delight. And then they go home and they Netflix binge. And they just do surprise without order. They escape into entertainment.
Yes.
And to say, no, the fullest life is order with surprise, and that's the life that the saints exhibit. And Chesterton has this great line. He says, break the conventions, keep the commandments, and you will live a full life. And I believe that even people who are far from the church can recognize that that's better. That's better than what the world offers. And it's only really possible for someone who believes in the commandments, but also believes in the God who makes all things new.
Very good. Well, hey, it was a delight talking to you. We'll have to have you back on the program. Where can people get a hold of your books and other things that you've written?
Well, the beauty book, Beauty, What It Is and Why It Matters, is on the Sophia Institute website. I have a couple other publications on Amazon. But thank you so much for having me, Garrett. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for all you do.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. That's John Mark Maravalli. It's beautiful, What It Is, Why It Matters by Sophia Institute Press. Pick it up, folks. It's a great read and very easy. It's beautifully written and highly recommended. Coming up next, High Intensity Catholic Talk Radio with Terry and Jesse Show. It's time for me to shut down the Midwest Command Center here. It's been a pleasure being with you today. And tomorrow, we're going to talk with Kenneth Hensley about meaning and materialism. Is it possible? Everybody have a great day. God willing, we'll talk again tomorrow. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.